Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
I'm fine. How are you? And tonight we're going to be talking with Guy. He's a 14-year Sun Dancer. And I'll let him pronounce his title and his organization. But before we do that, Mark would like to do a Mayan birth reading on him. And I don't know if he's ever had one, but most of our guests are really kind of astounded to how accurate they are. So take it away, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. I've never had one, no.
Oh, well. So in the traditional Mayan day count, you were born on a day called Five Men. The men is eagle. So a five celebrate one of the connections in it is the kind of the elevation or rising of creation. It would have to do in like in your different elements. It'd be the fifth element, the ether. And
uh-huh.
It's a kind of a partnering energy with things that have to do with the material world, but it tends to work a little bit more, maybe a little bit more on the spiritual side of the fence, and it can connect into, kind of relate to the top part of the pyramid. And again, like I said, so the five is the part that I just talked about. The other part, the men or the eagle, well, it's kind of, I guess, self-explanatory, you know, the eagle. And the eagle in many cultures is also one of the symbols of a connection between spirit world and earth, or in the Mayan thing, it's also the eagle is a liaison or a negotiator or whatever you want to call it between the sun and the earth. So there would be a connection, the whole thing with the sun dance.
Interesting.
Well,
you know, you mentioned the... Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Well, we can. There's another reading I'm getting ready to do, so we got to break it. We can break it. So if you had some question about just that part,
no, go ahead. No, that's fine. I'll come back to it.
All right. So that's in the traditional Mayan Zolcan or the Mesoamerican calendar, 260-day count. Now, the one I'm getting ready to do now is in the sixth sun, the next world cycle calendar, and it's got three components to it: a forward flow of time, the way we normally perceive things, the backward flow of time, which we don't, our senses don't detect except for our psychic sense can pick up on that, and then when the two time flows come together, they create a balancing point or a zero point. So we'll do the forward flow of time first. So this is more from your birth going forwards, and it's all about pretty much beauty, art, doing stuff with art. So I wouldn't be surprised if you had something in your fingers in artwork or some kind of creating or doing things pretty much all your life.
Sure. Yep.
And interestingly, already in the birth, I'm seeing it saying it's working in a partnership with a howl, which is a sun glyph. So this thing with the sun's been going back a long time for you. And it has a couple another layer levels cycles. They're bigger that have different things they bring to bear in it. First one would be next level up would be the mirror light cycle, kind of reflecting on things, giving off a. You may even do that yourself a lot, just be a mirror for other people to look at.
It
has a purpose of action. It has a purpose of action, getting things done. So, you know, it's not just sit around meditating stuff. It's something's going to happen here. You know?
Oh, I'm very much a doer, yes.
Yeah, a lot of action here. And it's tied in with potentially two star systems a lot come up with this particular glyph. One's not a star system. One's our planet Venus, which if you look in the Mesoamerican and even a lot of the Native American cultures in North America all over had something to say about Venus many times, or the dawn star, morning star, or whatever.
Yes.
The other one, the second component, this glyph comes up very frequently with this people that have some kind of connection with the star system of Arcturus in the Boots constellation. And Arcturus, Edgar Cayce said that both Arcturus and the Pleiades had an orbital relationship with our solar system.
Yes.
He also said that, particularly about Arcturus, he said that the Arcturians in our galaxy were known as the masters of love. So anytime any civilization in our galaxy got advanced enough in one way or another, in a ship or spirit or whatever, however they could do it, they'd find their way and make a little trip to Arcturus and visit. So that's on the forward flow, Tom. On the backward flow, that number 5 comes up again that we saw earlier, right? So all the ether and all that stuff, right? So that applies here too as well. And it's that number 5 is also about action, getting things done. And in this case, though, so in recent years, usually we pin it down somewhere around the year 1997, 1998, that this part of the reading might have started to become more noticeable in your life. And in a, it has, in a nutshell, it's a creator, or Hunepku from Mayan viewpoint. Mayans say that Hunepku is the one giver of movement and measure, which makes everything possible. It also has connotations here of harmony, bringing things together in harmony. But it works with another thing, and that's, in the simple thing, balance. Power, balance, and correct actions. And synchronizing things in harmony, being synchronistic, you know, things just kind of falling, almost like magically falling in place, right, that connect together. So you may have been seeing a lot of that type of activity happening here recently.
Yes, I have.
Especially if it has to do with truth. That would be a big, big component. So these two come together, forward and backward, flow of times, and where they create the zero point, or the balancing point, for you is a one manique, and its glyph looks like a hand, and it's often called the healing hand. It also symbolizes knowledge, so it would be knowing things, but also you probably have found this will give you a gateway to move across the bridge from this world cycle to the next, but also bring people with you. But you've probably found maybe that with this part, you just kind of like just attract healing stuff to you, like a magnet. Just stuff showing up, people too, probably.
And just people that need it, yes.
Right, yeah, both sides of the fence, maybe. Could be either one. But it has a real strong component of intention, how to get the intention focused on it. And also family, ancestors, which is part of the family, so not just the current family on Earth, but the ones that were here before too, and healing.
Yeah.
And
still
an
are somewhere.
Of, it's bringing back here an aspect of balance again, how to balance all that stuff for the healing. Many glyph is a black glyph, so it's more in the direction of the west. So this part of it is more kind of what helps you, and in the course of you doing it, helps others to move from one world cycle to the next.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. Nice. Yes, a lot of that fits very much.
Yeah, I thought we'd bring that grandfather into the conversation.
Yes, good.
Well, if you would, tell us, you know, what do you think about that, and tell us about your path and the times here as well.
Oh, golly.
Yeah.
Golly, lots to tell, I guess. Interesting. Where do I start? I don't know.
30 years ago.
In your introduction earlier on, you were talking about the survival, 500 years of resistance. And my biggest introduction into the Red Road was the Peace and Dignity Journeys. I don't know if you remember those. In 1992, after a Sundance in Taos, New Mexico, Tlaquiel and a group of elders at the dance came up with an idea to not to celebrate, but to honor the survival and resistance of the indigenous people of the Americas for 500 years, because it was just before the quincentennial was coming up. And somehow, long story to make it short, I ended up being the organizer for the Eastern Leg along with Bob Meniza, from Massachusetts to the Wampanoag Reservation to St. Louis. So it was a 1,200-mile leg of the Peace and Dignity Journeys. And some of you listening might remember the Peace and Dignity Journeys, which is still going on every 4 years now, 4 to 8 years. I haven't been really involved since 1992, but the run is still going on. You were also in the reading. He was talking about the fifth element, the ether. And interestingly, I've been talking about ether and thinking about it a lot lately. You know, we have the fire, the earth, the air, the water, the things we can at this time measure and quantify and see and experience. But there's that other one, what the Greeks called the ether. I don't know what else to call it, but there's another element. There's something else there. And the scientists have finally realized that only 15% of our universe can we actually see or measure or know what it is. The other 85% is this unknowable, dark energy, dark matter. They're trying to find other names for it. But we all know, those of us on this path and many other spiritual paths, know that there's a whole side of life that is there surrounding us all the time. I talk about the love of Creator that always surrounds us. You know, we don't think about it. We don't let it in a lot of times, but that's there. As soon as we open our hearts to it, it's there and fills us up. It's not always so easy when life is busy and challenging and difficult. But that thing, that energy, that love surrounds us all the time and connects us. You know, connects us with each other, with ourselves, with the ancestors, and with our Mother Earth, with all these natural elements around us. I'm a non-native person, I guess. As far as I know, I don't have any native blood. But I've always felt a strong connection to this path. Since I was very young, I've always been a seeker, looking for the path that would fit me. I remember when I was about 10, standing on the side of the road one time, feeling like I came from somewhere else to this earth for some mission. I had some project to do, something important to do in this world, and I didn't know what it was or where it would take me, and it's taken me many years to find out. But my life has always been a matter of things coming and doors opening and deciding, do I want to go this way or that way? And it's gradually led me here to where I am now. In 1990, I met Tlakielel, who was a Mexica Tolteca elder from Mexico. And we immediately felt this simpatico. Even before I spoke any Spanish and he spoke any English, we had this connection. And fairly quickly on, I began doing his organizing and scheduling, and then later, after I learned Spanish, translating and traveling with him. And that lasted 22 years until his crossover in 2012. Some call me a sun dancer and all that. I don't call myself that. I've been dancing at our mother dance in Teotihuacan for 23 years now. It's not 14 anymore. That was an older bio you got there. But again, I don't, you know, I'm just who I am. I'm just this old guy from Connecticut who's a social worker and a handyman, and maybe have learned a few things along the way in life and have tried to be of service to both the Red Road and to the people I come across. But I don't give myself a title. I don't call myself a chief or an elder or a medicine person. You know, other people may call me some of those things sometimes, but I don't want to put myself out there as having a certain position or authority or that sort of thing. I'm just who I am, and if people find it helpful to sit in one of my ceremonies, that's wonderful. If they want to come and talk to me or ask questions or whatever, that's great, but I do it as and just who I am.
Just an old man, right? That's the
just
highest
old
thing.
Guy, yeah.
Yeah, those high things you're probably inspired.
Yeah, I guess I just turned 70 this year, or last September, which is still, still doesn't feel like it. I feel like about 55, I think. Sometimes 16 now and then, 55 sometimes, and 90 once in a while, but not very often. But, you know, we've been around on this earth a while, and when you're here, if you've got your eyes open, especially if you're kind of a quiet person, I'm pretty quiet usually, so doing things like this interview is a bit of a stretch for me. But we quiet ones kind of sit in the back and watch and take in all that we see around us. And I've always been kind of an analyzer or a synthesizer, you know, taking this stuff in and then seeing how it fits together and what I can learn from it.
Well, now you're a gun, and you know I'm a Wilson through Clan Gun, and they've got that connection to the Sinclairs and Templars. So you know you've got a familial connection via your name to Clan Gun, and
oh yes.
Which is and then to Henry Sinclair and the Knight Templar. So, you know, you've got that's a rich heritage there. And there's a lot of crossover between the Templars and the Micmac flag is a mirror image of the Templar flag. And there's a lot going on there.
Nobody else I've ever met ever heard of the Gun Clan. That's actually my stepfather's last name.
Oh.
It's not my blood lineage. But he was...
Well, they have a lot of influence on us.
Yes, certainly a lot of influence. Well, that's very interesting. Nobody has ever known about that. Very interesting. Huh. The Wilsons are part of the Gun Clan, as I understand.
That's right. That's my mother's mother was a Wilson.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Small world, isn't it, huh?
Yeah.
I've always felt like the world, you know, seems like this big, huge place, but there's all these networks that go around, all these spider webs, these lines that connect all of us together. And those of us on this particular path, I guess you could say, or connected to this path, have all these connections around the planet. It's a wonderful thing. Sometimes we feel all alone because we're struggling with this or that in our lives, but then we start to realize, no, there's, you know, another million people struggling with the same things someplace. That's why I love flying. You know, you get up on the plane, you look down, you see all these little towns and villages and cities, and you see it with what Pluck Hill used to call the eye of the white eagle. You see it with a great perspective. Each person down below is struggling with their own issues, their relationships and their job and their finances and their history and all that. And it seems so important to each of us, but then you stand back from all that, and it's just a little speck in the eons of time, a little speck in the vastness of space. But we all think it's so important for each of us. And if we can get that perspective, then we don't maybe get as upset about the things that happen in our lives, even if they're seemingly tragic.
Yeah, that... I make that sound every time somebody says something really profound, and that was it.
Oh, thanks. well, you know, as I said, 23 years I was Pluck Hill's assistant, so I would do the at first just the organizing, and then later translating. And toward the end of his life, he started saying, you know, that now you're going to have to get up there. He'd announce to people, you know, that someday he's not going to travel anymore and I'm going to have to go over it, start traveling and doing some of the, teaching some of his message. And I was, no, I can't do that. I'm just the translator or the organizer. I want to be in the background. And then on his last day, maybe I'll tell you more about that later, but on his last day, he looked at me and said, okay, now you need to continue on. Traveling and passing on the message. And I didn't know at that point if I'd do any more traveling, because it had all been really, most of it, under his auspices or direction, or people wanted to have him come and do talks and ceremonies and all. But then since he passed, I've been actually traveling more than I did before.
Wow.
I don't understand it, but they keep asking me to come, so I keep going. I don't know what I can offer people, except that I have a great faith in life and a great belief in the basic goodness of people, even though it's a little shaky these days given our current politics and national feeling. But what I try to do is to help create a safe space for people, to create a mood, an energy, like in the Temescal, that's what we call the sweat lodge, to create a quiet place where people can pray and realize they're not alone. There's such a lot of loneliness in the world now, and such a lot of chaos and stress. We need those refuges. We need those quiet places we can come together and remember that we're all connected, and remember that Creator has all of us in His hands, so to speak, or her hands. There's no gender there, of course. So that's kind of what my mission is, I guess, and to help people realize the value of some of these traditions that have been around for thousands and thousands of years. You know, in our modern world, we want all the new stuff. And to a large degree, our culture has kind of swept away all the past. You know, that stuff doesn't matter anymore. Let's get the new stuff. 100 years ago, the grandparents could teach the children everything they needed to know to get through life. And now the children are teaching the grandparents how to run the phone, how to get stuff on their smartphone or on the computer, on their tablets. It's a strange, topsy-turvy world. And it tends to devalue the traditions of time. It tends to devalue that tradition of wisdom that is so important and has been always such an important part of life, to listen to the elders, to learn about the real important things in life, not just how to have fun and how to make money.
Well, that's true. You know, there's a real birth of history. You know, there's a lot that's been rewritten, particularly since in the last 100 years. For example, David Barton, the Wall Builders, was booked into as a speaker into Walter Reed Army Hospital as a speaker on Black history. And they purposely didn't put his face up. Of course, he's a white guy. And there's a little bit of consternation. But you know, when he got done, people were coming up to him and saying, "We had no idea that we had these heroes. We've never heard this history before." And about the founding fathers, you know, there's been a lot of crap written about them too, but you never heard any of it prior to, you know, about them supposedly being immoral. Nothing before about 1920. And so, you know, but you got this narrative going on, and everybody, you get, both left and right, you know, they live in their own echo chambers, and you know, you got to get out and talk to other people, and otherwise you're just going to end up going to war with each other, because it's just what happens.
Well, that's what's happening. People are afraid to talk to each other. They've gotten their minds closed, and I'm not sure why that's going on, but it's really a worldwide phenomenon, this level of anger and
egocentrism. Gorbachev said, "Hey, it looks like the world's getting ready for war."
Yeah, we're polarizing, but not just between countries, but between colors, between families. People have just forgotten that civility that was so important to keep life going. And it's been increasing, and not just this country. My friends in Europe are starting to see some of this over there. It's very scary.
Yeah, and you know, we had the same phenomenon, believe it or not, you know, speaking of Wilson, you know, after the Civil War and up up through World War One, or at least the turn of the century, things were desegregated, and it wasn't until like Wilson came in, Ku Klux Klan, and you know that people think that you know all the race hatred and everything went all the way back to after the Civil War. Not really so much, and it's because,
yeah,
you know, the history that's been written, and nowadays you don't even need to have taken any courses in American history to teach American history, and it's just weird, yeah. The things that are going on. It's crazy.
Yes, yes. If you want to learn history, read Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of, I can't remember, is it of America or of the World, one of the two, but. Yeah, history is, well, they always say history is written by the conquerors.
Right.
And well, Raphael used to say, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to, I was trying to remember who Zen was. He may have been what they called the last true liberal. Did he die recently? Or?
I don't know. Howard Zen was a humanitarian or humanistic historian, Zinn.
Right.
You'll find him everywhere. Tlaquiel used to say, "We need a worldwide re-education." That we're just so much on the wrong track, and people are getting kept so busy trying to make money to get that second car, to get put their kids through expensive school or whatever it might be, that they've forgotten how to really live. They're buying up all this prepackaged food because they haven't got time to really cook. And they're wondering where all the money goes.
Well, you know what you're saying there reminds me of one of the things Lame Deer said, one of the Lakota. He said he had a vision of a highway, and people were moving on the highway going just as fast as they could. They faster, faster, faster. He said, at the end of the highway is a pit, a deep, dark pit. Mm-hmm. So they're going as fast as they can to go into a pit.
A bunch of lemmings we are, yeah. That may have to happen. We may have to end up in a pit. We may have to start over again. I don't know. I really don't know what's going to happen. But it's a time to keep close with your friends and loved ones. It's a time to keep the connection strong and be ready to stand up and make a stand of what's important. You know, to like the Women's March was so meaningful to me to see people get up there and put their mouth where the money where their mouth is, so to speak. And that makes a statement. That says something. I hope they keep going with that. I was disappointed when the Occupy movement sort of petered out or went underground. But it's nice to see people ready to hit the streets again.
Well, where do we go from here? You've got have got all the time you need, or we can just go to the top of the hour.
We'll just keep going until we run out of stuff to say.
Sounds good.
Let me tell you a little bit about Tlaquiel, since that was a pretty big part of my life. He was a Mexica Tolteca elder who just had a tremendous, the person with the most drive I've ever met in my life. He lived on pure will. He had diabetes, emphysema, heart trouble, you name it, and was close to death many, many times, but had this amazing force of will to create all kinds of things. He returned to Sundance to Mexico in, what was it now, mid-80s, I guess it was, early 80s, somewhere around there. Maybe about 1980, I'm not sure of the year, when he encountered the dance and at Crow Dogs and was the first, one of the first non-Lakota to dance there. He recognized it as a old Mexica tradition. So not too long after that, after he finished his 4 years, I guess, he returned the dance to Mexico. And it's been there now 34 years. And now there must be at least 15 or 20 Sundances in Mexico. It's been pretty amazing to watch the growth of this whole movement, you know, where people come together to give of themselves, to make a sacrifice and ask prayers for all the people. He also, with the Peace and Dignity Journeys and all, was able to get in Caltono, which you might call a Native Mexican church, the first indigenous spiritual organization to be recognized by the government in 500 years. And it's now officially recognized by the Mexican government, which is an amazing achievement.
What year was that?
The
recognition from what year was? Do you remember the year of Mexico recognized?
Sorry, your voice is breaking up some there.
Do you remember the year Mexico recognized them?
Yes, that it was, I think, 1993 or 1994.
Hmm.
I think it
was
93. I've got some papers somewhere.
That was before the Senate records it. And, Cherokee Nation of Mexico was the first nation recognized just weeks after the San Andres Accord, the Mexican Constitution. And that particularly for what you hear about Mexico and, now in public, a native worship. So anyway, go ahead. Fascinating.
Yeah, he was an amazing, what they call impulsador, the impulser. He started so many people on the path. He just had an amazing charisma to inspire people. I happen to have the, I don't know what you'd say, honor, fortune, whatever, to be there in his last days. In 2012, he'd organized a big celebration for the 30th anniversary of the dance in Mexico. He had a hall rented, he had a caterer, he sent out over 300 invitations to all kinds of dignitaries and people that had been part of the movement many, many years ago. And then when I was with him in June, again of 2012, he announced he was going to get married. We were all kind of, whoa. They said he was going to get married at the Sundance right before this big celebration. That was going to be partly a wedding celebration. And he was going to surprise Susanna, his fiance. Well, she didn't even know she was fiance, but his girlfriend at the time. And I said, well, maybe you better ask her. Maybe a good idea to ask her first before you make a big public announcement. So when I got down to the dance, our dance is always the last weekend in July. When I got down there a few days before the dance, he told me that he had asked her, and yes, they were going to get married. In Mexico, it's in that area of Teotihuacan, it's not legal to cut trees. So they have to be very surreptitious to get a Sundance tree and find somebody that's willing to give one up and make a deal with the landowner and often cut it in the middle of the night. First of all, when we arrived there, he sent all the other dancers up the hill to get ready for the dance. Ours is on the side of Cerro Gordo, this beautiful mountain overlooking the pyramids, but it's a long walk up the hill, a good hour and a half, 2 hours, if you're carrying a backpack, up this quite steep hill. He sent them up and told me to stay behind, had a little project for me. And the hall that he had rented to have the big celebration had no lights or electricity hookup yet. And he had these bands already booked. It was going to be partly at night. So he'd bought a generator and said, well, I have a little project for you. And with Tlaquel, I knew when he had a little project, it was always going to be a humdinger. So it was to wire the building for lights and sound, so the bands could play and people could see, because they had all these tables set up for 300 people to be there. So I said okay, and so we got the building wired. But I could tell he was very tired at that point. Every time he sat down, he closed his eyes and he sort of fell asleep. We went out to get some lunch after we finished. And he fell asleep during the meal. He was very tired, as he always is at that point. Because we'd been in Europe not a month before the dance. We had a very short amount of time to get ready. And Tlaquiel always was in charge of everything, so it was a lot of stress, a lot of pressure on him. But anyway, so the next night, I guess it was time to get the tree. And he called up about 10 o'clock at night to have the dancers all come down in the dark, down this very steep path to come get the tree. He had a tree picked out somewhere. And we begged him to stay in the house. He was already pretty sick with a lung congestion and a cold at that point. So we begged him to stay home and not to go get the tree. But of course, Tlaquiel's will was so strong, he said, no, I'm going to go just for a few minutes. I said, well, I don't think you're going to stay a few minutes, but okay, you know, you do what you want. So we went to get the tree, and it took, must have taken a good 3 hours. We didn't get back to the house till after 1 a.m, and he was just exhausted. It was also very cold and damp out, and that was always a big problem for his lungs. So we kind of went downhill from there, and a couple of doctors came out to stay with him. And the next day, he told me to go head up with the tree and start the dance. He'd be okay. He'd come up in a couple of days. I wasn't sure, but he just gave me the orders, you know, you go up and start the dance. So we started the first day of the dance in the, I guess it was the second round, I think. Lightning struck the Sundance tree. The tree didn't fall, but it struck, there's a whole stripe going down the side of the tree. We were sitting under in the rest area, which is this huge, sort of like a circus tent, but it's not as luxurious as a circus tent. It's that big old blue tarp with these metal posts going up through the middle of it, two big posts, like lightning rods. And this we always get a big storm during the Sundance there. And there was this lightning was crashing all around, and the rain was pouring down, and then all of a sudden we had this big crash. We looked around, because here we are sitting under this tent with these metal poles between all of us. So we looked around, we were all alive, nobody got hit by lightning or anything. So I went out and looked in the circle, and all the stuff that was in the center of the circle was scattered all around the circle. The tree was still standing, but I could see the stripe going down the tree where the lightning had hit it. And we sent word to Tlaquiel at that point. He was very excited. He always had a strong connection to lightning. In fact, he'd been touched by lightning, I think, 3 times before. So he thought that was a really exciting sign. So we finished that day of the dance, and people kept checking, you know, how is he doing? And he said he was a little better. He'd be up the next day. And then the next morning, as we were getting ready to go in the circle, they called me out and told me he was very grave and wanted to see me. So I packed up all my stuff and ran down the hill as fast as I could and got to the house and found him lying in bed with Susanna taking care of him. And he was having a very hard time breathing. He had oxygen, but he kept taking the oxygen off so we could talk more. And he told me at that point that he was going to die that day. He said he was happy. He was going to see his mother again. It was the 26th of July, which is this very auspicious day for him, because that's the anniversary of the founding of Mexico Tenochtitlan and the return of the Four Arrows journey, which another long story. But anyway, he was very excited that it was that day, and he was going to see his mother, and he said he had no pain. His voice was very weak, and he had to really work to talk because his lungs weren't working very well. But he said he was in no pain. And he also said that they got married that morning, knowing he was going to go that day. They got married that morning. And he told me to take pictures and doing recordings that day because he wanted people to know they shouldn't be afraid of death. You know, we have such a fear of death in our culture. We're afraid to talk about it. We're afraid to look at it. A person dies, and they put them in a box and whisk them away, and maybe we get back a little box of ashes or something, or see a casket later. In Mexico, the person actually is laid out often on the kitchen table or somewhere on the floor for at least a day where people can actually say goodbye and see that they're gone. So anyway, so he told me to do recordings and take pictures, and I've got a whole slideshow I've been doing about his passing. So the whole day he spent teaching, talking about the importance of the 26th of July, the Confederation of Anahuac, which went from Nicaragua to the north, because that was a different one from Nicaragua to the south, the Tohontinsuyo. So we went on and on teaching about that, then talking to each of us about what we're supposed to be doing, giving us our orders, so to speak, and just spent the whole day talking. He called up many people on the phone and told them he was going to be leaving that day, kind of opposite what you usually expect. You know, usually people say, no, I'm fine. I've heard nobody else announced they were going to die that day, but that was kind of his style. I don't think he planned it ahead. I don't think he knew he was going to die at some point before that, but I think he finally said, okay, I've completed my mission, I can go now. And they, like I said, they just had gotten married that morning. So the Sun Dancers all came down in small groups. He didn't want to stop the dance, but he said some could come down now and then. And a bunch group came down after the end of the dance that day and were singing down below. I've got this wonderful recording of it, the Sun Dancers singing the Sun Dance songs and drumming right down below in the room below him. He was very happy about that. Then he asked for just five of us to come in with him. And so we spent the last hour or two with him, I guess. And like I said, he gave us each our orders and told us all to keep working with each other and don't let the petty stuff get in the way, which is important. And talked about how, I forget how, what did he say exactly? Something about now he's going to reintegrate with the cosmos. I think that's how he put it. And he said, go ahead and, you know, keep the dance going. Don't stop the dance. And have a celebration. It's okay to make it a bit of a funeral, but make it a happy one. And just before 8 o'clock that night, I think it was 7:57, on the 26th of July in 2012, he went through a period where he was kind of like shaking off the body. I don't know if you've been with people who were passing, but sometimes they go through a period where they kind of shake a lot, and it's like a snake shedding its skin or a butterfly coming out of its cocoon, maybe. And then he got very quiet, and it just went. So we were both happy for him and grieving at the same time. And then we brought him out to the other room and laid him on the floor, and women started bringing flowers in, made this beautiful four colors circle of flowers. And then people started, who he'd called, started coming, arriving as fast as they could. And then the next day we took him to the crematory. In Mexico, when there's a cremation, the family goes with the body and waits while they're being cremated. In our country, you know, it's all kind of behind the scenes and taken out of our hands. And normally they don't allow people to witness the cremation at all, even in Mexico. But one of the guys, Don Beto, knew the owner of the crematory. And they got talking about tradition and that sort of thing, and he allowed four of us to go in the back and put tlaquil in the oven. But when we took him out back, he left the door open, and everybody else came out. and we're singing and dancing. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen what they call Aztec dancing now. But the whole time he was being cremated in the oven right behind us, people were singing and dancing and just sitting in little circles talking. And it was the most beautiful day. There's never a really clear sky there because of all the pollution and all, but the sky was this beautiful blue sky with wisps of clouds, a little bit of showers now and then. Someone went out and got some food and some soda, and then we brought the ashes, but when it was finished, we brought the ashes back. And one, he asked for his ashes to be divided in three parts, one to go with his mother's ashes at his sister's house, one part to go up to the, to be put in the Sundance Circle, and one part to go to Serpent Mountain, where he does his, I guess you'd say, his 40-day vision quest, or his hermitude. What really started him on the road many years ago. So they did that, and then the next day everybody came down from a dance and got changed and cleaned up as best they could, and we had the celebration. And instead of 300, there were about 450 people there. But the lights worked, the sound system worked, and it was just this beautiful celebration. It was partly a funeral, partly a celebration of the 30th anniversary of the dance, and partly a wedding reception. Susanna was there in her wedding dress. And she was the most amazing person, you know. She was grieving in a way, but she had tremendous grace and dignity and was just so happy that they could have gotten married and happy to be a part of his life. It's quite an amazing story. At some point, I'm going to get it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Into a video or a book or something, or both. Yeah. But, you know, life and death are just two sides of a coin. We're here in this world for a while, and then we're somewhere else. I don't really know where we go, but I know I've been around enough in life to know that there's certainly a lot more than we see. And life doesn't just stop. I've been in ceremonies where just amazing things have happened, and simple things too. Enough to know that life doesn't end it when the body stops functioning. That it's just one. This is just one little phase of life.
Well, what you're saying there reminds me of, some of the quantum scientists have basically come up and said, "Well, your mind ain't in your body."
Yes.
Even while you're in, even when you are in your body, it's not there. And
yes,
they've basically now, in some of their things, say that you're what we call your mind or awareness or consciousness or whatever exists somewhere else, and our brain is just a receiver type of thing that connects into that vast consciousness and can
yes.
pull information and make connections and stuff. So it's interesting that we're you know, what we think makes our thinking in our brain and everything is really not even in our body. So
yes.
what happens when we die? Well, probably all that it is that kind of connection between that kind of gets broken from the body. But the other part, the most significant part, the mind, the consciousness, awareness, that's all still there.
Yes, yes.
But it,
oh, you're
right. But it also, what it does, I think, too, and I think this does it in maybe certain Sundances or certain ceremonies and stuff, is that one of the things that can happen in some of the traditions in most cultures is they teach, you know, to try to heighten that awareness of the other side is to kind of break from your senses, the sensory input of your eyes, ears, and all that, and kind of shut it down and be quiet so that you can...
Mm-hmm.
get the other part working and pay attention
yes.
to it. So, you know, what we it's the opposite of what we think. Maybe, you know, we think our senses and ears, eyes, and all that is, you know, like everything. And probably most of the time we need to kind of shut it down and get our attention focused a little bit more on the other side.
Back to ether again.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Like, you know,
yeah.
Mike Bastien was telling us that years ago he was approached by an astrophysicist, and he just said, how is it that Native people know so much about the cosmos that we're just now beginning to comprehend and understand? They've been working pretty closely.
Yeah. Well, because we've been stuck in the brain, our culture, the larger culture has been stuck in the brain. And, of course, the brain isn't the only thinking part of our bodies, even.
Yep.
You know, they're now realizing that there's nerve cells that actually do thinking in the heart, in the chest, and all through the body. It's not just the brain, even.
Oh, any cop will tell you about his gut, you know.
Yes, exactly. And that's a real thing. You know, and now, and it's not just us. You know, I'm realizing as time goes on that even my body is not one thing. You know, it's a collection of all these cells that are kind of working together. And in fact, what do they say? Only 10% of the cells in our body are human cells. The rest are bacteria. You know, the bacteria in our skin, the bacteria in our gut. There's something like, is it 10 trillion human cells we have? And then it's 100 trillion other cells. And they're finding out now, too, that the gut bacteria are actually telling us what to eat to some degree. They're actually controlling us by enzymes they produce that go out to our body and all. It's a lot more complex than we realize. But, you know, when I sit in the lodge, I can see often the elders sitting around. You know, if you let go of some of the normal senses, and I don't see a lot. You know, I get an idea of things or sense things, but I don't really have visions much or hear voices or that sort of thing. But I get a sense of things. But in the lodge, I can often sort of see, you know, a whole group of elders sitting around the outside, just kind of watching. I've had a lot of unusual, not a lot, but a few very unusual experiences. Many years ago, my elderly neighbor across the street, he was an old Finnish guy, and his wife died, and she was in a hospice program. We went to the memorial they do in hospice every year, and they gave us each flowers. So we thought, well, we'll go put them on her grave. So we went to the cemetery, and we started walking up to the grave, and this little black crow, it was not small, actually, but I think it was young, kept opening his mouth, and it wasn't speaking, but it kept opening and closing his mouth right at Arvid as we walked up there. And then we finally got up to the grave and put the flowers on, and this crow then jumped on top of his head. And he knocked it off and jumped up there again. It was so menacing, we ended up running down the driveway. This thing is going, yak, yak, yak. We got in the car, closed the doors, and this crow jumped on top of the car, grabbed one of the windshield wipers, and it wasn't until halfway home, and I ran the wipers, that the bird finally flew off. And it was exactly like his wife. She was always kind of complaining and demanding, and it was very interesting. I've had a fair number of experiences like that, you know, something's going on that we're not aware of.
Well, my brother-in-law, I've been a widow twice, and my second wife, Betty's brother, passed away about 5 months after we got married. And we all drove down to his mom's house, and we were sleeping on the floor the morning of the funeral. And just as they were starting to get a little light coming in the room, I heard his voice clear as a bell, and he laughed, and he said, "Well," uh-huh. And he laughed. He said, "I guess I'm dead," and he said, "Tell Mom we are Pate clan on the Cherokee side and the Wielded Sword clan on the Celtic side," and you know, and then. We at the funeral, right about the time I picked up my guitar to lead everybody in Amazing Grace, this zephyr wind came directly out of the west, direct direction of the spirit camp, and it blew so hard that you could hardly hear yourself think. And it was so obvious what was going on, so obvious what was going on.
Yeah.
Richard was having a little fun with us.
Yeah.
Yep.
It works like that. There's a group I belonged to for many years called the Sabian Assembly, which is kind of a philosophical esoteric study group. And it was started by Mark Edmund Jones, back in the 20s. He was probably the foremost American astrologer, but he did a lot more than that. But anyway, there's one ceremony called the Dedication of a Departure, which is like a memorial service. And in part of it, part of it is we they pass around a bowl of dirt of earth, and each person runs their hands through it and says they dedicate their, well, they'll, what they can to help keep the person's memory alive within us. But then there's a period where there's a, I don't know if it's 2 or 3 minutes of silence, where we allow the person to make their presence known in some way. And always something interesting happens. Things fall off a shelf, or the wind blows, or the rain starts, or something happens. There's always some message at that point. It's very interesting. I remember being up at Graham Twyla's many years ago, when I was just started with Lock LL. There was a gathering of elders there, the first Wolf Song gathering. All kinds of interesting people were there. But her son had died in a tragic fire within a year before that. And they'd asked Wildcat, I don't know if you ever knew him, a Mi'kmaq elder, to do a little ceremony in this grove of pine trees. So we start this ceremony, and this fly keeps landing on his nose. He brushes the fly off, comes back, same place on the nose. He brushes it off, comes back again, brushes it off, comes back again. He finally said, okay. And the fly just sat there the whole rest of the ceremony. As soon as it was over, it flew off again. So you never know about these things. But I don't know how all this stuff works. But I know there's a lot there that we don't understand with our brains, with our minds. That life is a lot fuller than we realize. And what we really need comes to us. I felt the need for many years for a partner. And, you know, finally sort of felt that, well, it's not going to come in my life. You know, just resigned myself to being single. I've been married a couple of times, but it wasn't what I call a real partnership. And about the time I decided, well, okay, you know, I'm just, this is where my life's going to be. And I met this amazing woman in Holland, and it just kind of, boom, all of a sudden it was clear. That was it. We're trying to figure out how we're going to work it now, being across the ocean from each other. But we'll figure out. We'll make it work somehow.
That's like I've heard so many people say, you know, we try and try and try to have a baby, and then when we quit trying, that's when it came.
Yes. Yeah, and that it works that way. And, you know, when these things happen, you also know there's a purpose to it. It's not just for our own pleasure. You know, Yvonne and I know it's not just for us. We've got some work to do, some mission to do together. And I think all of us come into, as Tlaquil used to talk about, into life with a mission. He used to talk about the code of destiny, which was a parallel code to the genetic code. We have the double helix. One part's the genetic code. One part's the code of destiny. And destiny is like a wide road. You can walk down it, and you can go over this side, and then you hit the wall. Then you go over the other side, and you hit the wall. And, you know, you keep going back and forth, but you end up at the end of the road, no matter what. But we all have this destiny. We all have some mission in life that we're here to do. Maybe it's to raise the next generation, to raise the family. Maybe it's to do some big project. We don't know what it is when we start, but we find out as we go along. And that's always been very conscious in my mind, that we're all here for some purpose. It's good to keep that in mind and to keep looking at what our purpose is.
Well, it's like John C. Reilly saying about in the Dewey Cox story, it's a beautiful ride.
Yes, it is. It's not an easy one usually, but it's beautiful. You know, we didn't come here for a vacation. We came here to work, to learn.
That's right.
You know, to grow and to be of service. I've always felt that probably the most important part of life is to be here of service. And when you're dedicating yourself to service, your needs get met somehow, but not necessarily easily. You know,
that's true.
And our world these days is certainly a huge amount of stress and challenge. But you know, we're here together doing it. And the most important thing to me is that we stay together, we keep our connection strong, and we realize that everything's in cycles. You know, there's great cycles going on. We're in this very strange cycle right now, which is all this other, maybe all this anger and this selfishness has to come out to the surface to get cleansed. I don't know.
Well, there's a 40-year and an 80-year cycle, and we're right about the same as it was right before World War II. And this this generation, they call the millennials. They're going to have to save the situation, and they're going to have to work it out, and because we're walking away, and it's going to work out. It's going to work out. It's going to be a lot of changes, and all we can do is just get out of the way.
Well, we also to be there, like you're doing, like I guess we're all doing, to be there, giving a little advice, reminding people why we're here, and to offer these little bits of wisdom, these little bits of perspective that young people don't usually have. I guess that's the role of an elder.
Oh, yeah.
To give a perspective, to remind people that life goes on. You know, each of the grandfathers had a grandfather who had a grandfather who had a grandfather, and these traditions, the songs, the ceremonies, all of this comes from way back and keeps on going. We each, like Gil again used to say, we're a link in the chain of evolution. You know, we've each got a little piece to play. It doesn't all land on our shoulders, but we do our bit. And then we're wherever we go next.
Yep, that's the truth. You know, we've got someone called in earlier, and I wasn't able to raise them. Area code 515. 829, have you got a question, or were you just listening? Area code 515. I guess they were just listening, so I wasn't able to raise them earlier.
Maybe they'll call back in again.
Yeah, sometimes people just call in just to listen. And
I see. Interesting.
I've got now... I checked my email. I haven't gotten your new bio, so send that to me. I'll get the new one up as soon as possible, and
so
people know how to get in touch with you. Now, the show will be up for several years until, every time you add a show, you know, it bumps one off, and there's hundreds and hundreds now, but you'll be able to download it and meet with it about 40 minutes.
Wonderful.
Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. You know, the time's yours. Long as you want to go.
Not sure where I was, but we met down in Illinois at that interesting gathering.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
That was quite a wild time.
That was wild. It really was.
I was right in the middle of Mormon country, right in this place where... Joseph Smith, I guess, landed there as a refuge, escaping from somewhere else, right? Isn't that how the story went?
Well, they found the church, founder of the church in New York, and then they moved to Kirtland, Ohio, and then they got run out of there, and then they moved to Nauvoo, and then they got run out of there, and they went to... Independence, Missouri before I think I've got the timer lighted. Maybe they went to Independence for, I can't really remember right now, but Joseph was murdered, in Carthage, 20-30 miles south of there. And it's interesting. A lot of people don't know he was running for president of the United States and winning.
Yes.
And
winning, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there was steamboats going up and down the Mississippi River. They were polling. It was all a big deal in the Eastern newspapers. And there was a book published about, 30 years ago or so,
Don Oaks. He was president of BYU when I was there. And he's one of the Supreme Court justices in Utah. But they documented that there were representatives from every state of the union there to make sure that he didn't live. And
really interesting. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. It was an assassination. It was a political assassination. It really didn't have
that
a whole
I
lot
knew,
to do
yeah.
with religion and because
yeah.
it was really trying to shake things up and but it you know he did he knew see he had taken off and had headed west and he was going to go to the Rocky Mountains and then a rider came out and convinced him to go back and he knew he says well I go like a lamb to the slaughter and but yeah, and the really interesting thing, the big takeaway I got from my association with the church is that Section 85 of the Doctrine and Covenants, he was, of course, he got in trouble with Creator several times for being disobedient, and he at one point asked, well, when am I going to really be able to get a visitation, and he was told, kind of giving the brush off. He says, "Well, trouble me no longer on this subject. But if you live to be 85 years old, you know you'll see me again." And his 85th birthday was 5 days before the massacre at Wounded Knee. And had he lived and gone to the Salt Lake Valley, see, they were, the Book of Mormon instructed them to look for a choice Indian seer. And that's what they were looking for. And Brigham Young followed up on that when they went west, but they kind of gave up. They got tangled up with the Utes, and he kind of came to the conclusion that Indians were just savages. But and Brigham died in 1877. But in the late 1890s, the Ghost Dance movement started up. And that year that he would have been 85 years old was 1890. And, you know, according to the Indians, you know, Jesus arrived in a kind of a donut-shaped craft with a kind of a throne or a chair in the middle. And when he stood up, he says there seams appeared in the sides of the donut and like metal flowed down. And he gave him the ghost dance, and it's not the ghost dance that everybody thinks it is, a round dance. It's a spiral dance, and but you can go to original ghostdance.com, or you can go to YouTube and you can see it. It's Wovoka's grandson, Andy Vidovich, instructed the cast and crew, which he was a part of, Billy Jack, and of course you may have known Rolling Thunder. And it was in the movie Billy Jack. It was documented.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I never knew.
Yeah, it's crazy. And he had a tremendous gift of prophecy. You know, people just
yes.
You know, they don't look at some of the facts, but yeah, that was it took me about 7 years to begin to figure things out that way, and that's, you know, when I started visiting Rolling Thunder, and he kind of radicalized me,
yeah,
that put me on the red road in 85.
Wow, yeah, I was a little bit later. Well, I was starting to look at this stuff then. I went to some of your old Medicine Mule gatherings that Sunbeard put on in New York State.
Oh, yeah, I wish I would have known him.
Go ahead.
Oh, and they're defaming, for so many years, they've defamed Sunbear, including his daughter. And now all of a sudden, Winona, you know, now all of a sudden they're quoting him. That's crazy.
Yes, that happens a lot, you know. I've seen that happen with like Ale, even, you know, people complain about the way he did certain things, and then they're quoting him.
Oh yeah, it's really crazy, and
I don't know. It's, you know, it is what it is. What can you say?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people are afraid of change, and I think a lot of traditional people are not so comfortable with sharing knowledge and with mixing ceremonies, for example.
Right.
So, you know, many feel it should be just one way, you know, just the Lakota teachings or just the Cree or just the Mi'kmaq, whatever. And a lot of people shouldn't be a part of it. But if you go back to the old elders, the previous generation that's pretty much gone now, they were very inclusive, most of them.
Right. Yeah, they sure were. Yeah, there's a real
it's
racism.
That next generation.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
There was a real racism that came up inside people. It was all about pride and, you know, who's an Indian and all that kind of crap.
Yeah. But there was a lot of abuse, too, you know. There were a lot of people making a lot of money out of the teachings or ceremonies. You know, you can go lots of places and pay a huge amount of money for Sundance or a Vision Quest or you could die.
And as a result, you could die. You know, because some stupid ass decides he's going to do things just in a crazy way. And, oh, jeez, it's a mess. It's a real mess.
Yeah.
Well, hey,
it's not stuff to fool around with.
Yeah. The stream is going to run out in a few minutes, and there's some messages I want to tack onto the end. So,
okay.
If there's anything you want to say, go ahead.
Well, I guess I just reiterate again that we're all here with a purpose. And maybe we need to get everything shaken up. Maybe that's why Trump's the president. I don't know. But things are getting shaken up. They weren't really working very well before. We need to find a new way to work it. And it may go through this really tough period.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, a lot of fear out there. And our purpose, or my purpose anyway, and maybe for a lot of us, is to kind of calm the waters, to remind people that these indigenous traditions who have been here for thousands of years worked out a lot of things, and
yep.
we can learn a lot from them.
Well, you know, as far as
if
Trump
we do
goes, you know,
humility.
I was just as offended as everybody else is or was at him. And I got to thinking, Trump, oh, you know, geez, aren't there Trumps mentioned in the Hebrew scriptures? And I got to thinking, so I went, huh, well, let's see if anybody's had a prophecy about him. Well, darn, here we go. There was, of course, the Hebrew way, they say there's everything is established by two or three witnesses. Well, there was a 2011 retired firefighter was given a prophecy saying that he would be president someday. And then I found another one from 2007, and that was recorded, and it was really interesting because Creator told this guy, "Well, I'm going to fool the people. It's not going to be, you know, what they think it's going to be." And then I discovered that Baba Vanga, the Russian prophetess, had a prophecy that seems to kind of look toward him, but. This whole thing with Russia, I think, is very important because, you know, Edgar Casey said that the hope of the world would come out of Russia. But there's this, back in the mid-80s, I read a book called Nostradamus Predicts the End of the World by Rene Neuberg. And you know, I was telling my friends in the Guard out in Oregon, hey, you know, we're going to become allies with Russia. And the Berlin Wall's gonna. I was laughed to derision. Well, about 5 years later, it happened, and for a while we were allies with them, and it just seems like the elites in Washington want to, you know, keep us, you know, at odds with them, and when you look at the world from there, you know, if the Russians had military bases in Canada and Mexico, we wouldn't just be screaming about it. We'd be going to war with them. And
exactly.
But there's a Brothers of Aquilon, a Brothers of the Eagle prophecy that has to be fulfilled. sometime in the future in order to defeat what Nostradamus called the powers of the East, whatever they are. And now we're finding out today that it looks like India is going to become kind of part of the picture too. So it's going to be some real changes. It's going to shake up a lot of people.
It's going to be interesting to watch. Well, you know, we humans are such crazy creatures. You know, here we are fighting with Germany during the war and fighting with Japan, and now we're friends.
Yeah.
You know, and this has been on through the eons of time. We've made enemies, and we make friends who work together. You know, Vietnam
right.
is his arch enemy. And then now people are going to Vietnam. We're getting Vietnamese food. We love it. You know, all these that polarization ends up coming back around together.
Crazy.
It's yeah, we're kids. We're little kids who haven't learned how to play together yet.
That's right.
And
That's
right now it's getting worse. We're getting more polarized and more further apart. But at the same time, this amazing stuff is coming together. Look at the Women's March. Look at all the groups getting together. The Pipeline, the Standing Rock, what an amazing thing that's been. The people, you know, these, 200 nations or more gathered there that had not been really in communication for hundreds of years are arm in arm working together.
And there was a report that he had ordered it moved 70 miles away, you know, from the reservation. And he says, we're not going to build it with Chinese steel, which tends to break. We're going to use American steel.
We'll see how that works out.
Everybody hold on to your hat. Well, we probably ought to appreciate you, Bert.
Sure. One last quick thing. If you want to find out what's going on in the world, just follow the money. Follow who's making money out of it, and that's what's going on in the physical world. In the spiritual world, it's a whole different thing. So, well, thank you very much. It's been nice to talk with you.
Hey, you're welcome.
You're
welcome.
It's a nice thing you're doing. It's so important to have these archives. Save the old ones somewhere, I hope.
Oh yeah, I got them.
Archive them too. Good.
Yep,
and I hope you have a backup somewhere. Lots of backups for all that stuff. Good.
I certainly do. Well, thanks a lot, guys.
Good.
Have a good night.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
Bye bye.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.
Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. If you have been listening to our program for long, then you know that Mark the Badger Borcherding does a Mayan birth reading for each of our interview guests. Mark suggested that he give away a free reading for each donation of $20 or more to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a ministry of Oklava Native American Church, or the White Roots of Peace. So please support Prophecy Keepers Radio by making your free will offering at nativeamericanchurch.us, and you'll receive this gift reading. If you choose to make a recurring donation, once you've received your own reading, you can give readings away as free gifts. So why not head over to nativeamericanchurch.us and make an offering right now. Hope to be talking with you soon. Bye now.
difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom.
There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater, encouraging you to obtain an authorized participant or AP card and become a federally recognized Native religious practitioner. Presently, Aklavan Native American Church is the only Native American church spiritually blessed by the Rosebud Reservation Native American Church and has a certificate of existence in the state of Utah that is authorized to worship on or off tribal grounds and has met the Standard of Sincerity and Vow of Poverty standards in the state of Utah and federal courts. This card is designed to assist all people regardless of their racial makeup, political affiliation, social and/or financial status, and receiving their constitutional rights. This card is also designed to assist United States judicial officials to honor their solemn oath to protect and exercise the principles of the United States Constitution while carrying out their duty and serving their fellow citizens. To join the movement that is strengthening and exercising the principles of the United States Constitution, please obtain your AP card by visiting NativeAmericanChurch.us today.
Dry ground, sagebrush and mesquite and chaparral around, out away is a big dust devil moving on its way. I guess they're never still. In a sacred manner I live, to the heavens I gaze. In a sacred manner I live. My horses are many. The high grass and the cedar, the mighty oak and the tiny flower, the sandstone in the valley, mountains high and running streams. In a sacred manner I live, to the heavens I gaze. In a sacred manner I live. My horses are many.